who for 3 years has shared with us her decades of research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's May.
Good afternoon. This is May Brussel, Carmel, California. A hot Monday afternoon out here, September 30th, 1974. And this is Dialogue Conspiracy number 164. Today we're going to talk a lot about a famous gentleman who had a cold, which developed into a pneumonia, and then in a short while, he had a blood clot in his leg, and the blood clot was went to his heart, and the gentleman was diagnosed as having a cancer, and it became fatal, the blood clot. And all this was all in a 3 week period, and that gentleman was Jack Ruby. And I was reading my files and research over a period of time back in 1967 in January, when Jack Ruby died, and I saw a lot of parallels between the illness and the diagnosis and the prognosis of Richard Nixon with Jack Ruby, and I thought maybe I'd share some of those with you. That's the advantage of saving newspaper articles over the past 10 years, as much as I could accumulate on the political assassinations. I keep them in chronological order, and they're not indexed, but I can get to them in a certain way. It takes a little longer than if they were indexed, but I can find them. And I saw so many parallels between Richard Nixon's disease and his hospitalization and the demise of Jack Ruby that I thought I would share some of that for you in case you don't remember the details. I also have here a copy of the Berkeley Barb this week, which has a long article. The title of it is "The Green Berets Shot a Yendi." And next week we'll go into a lot of the details of the article. The person knowledgeable on the murder of Salvador Allende in Chile claims that the task force was trained at a super secret CIA base near Fort Ord and at Fort Gulick, G-U-L-I-C-K, in the Panama Canal Zone. Fort Ord, of course, you know, is my home base. The disclosures came out this week in a long article in a paper in Watsonville nearby, the Register Peronian, by Betty Brown, and it has many details of the murder of Allende, and the information was provided by a professor who knows the exact details. He said that they were trained for several months before the coup in September 73, and team members were told they had a special mission to accomplish, and later they'd be told the details. And everyone in that mission was Spanish-speaking and received counterinsurgency training. As I say, they were trained at Fort Ord under Pentagon orders on a U.S. Air Force cargo plane. They were taken to the Panama Canal Zone, then to San Diego, and again on U.S. Air Force plane they departed. The U.S. Army fatigues had no identifying ID patches. They wore African-type bush hats. They were armed with 7.62 caliber M14 automatic rifles. They stormed the palace and were responsible for the murder of Allende. The article claims that they were ordered to take him alive, not to kill him. But again, there were so many discrepancies in the killing of Diem in Vietnam at the time of that military coup by the CIA. And allegedly, they were supposed to take him alive. This is what we heard for many years. And then later, it turned out that there were orders not to take him alive. And it makes it more humanitarian to say that we wouldn't take the leaders of the country, but just by coincidence, they are killed by the CIA. This article says that each of the three American units, the Special Forces Rangers, the CIA, separately and independently, according to this story, all played a part. There were 234 Special Forces troops that acted as an independent unit. You see, the reason they act independent is so that the major agencies don't take the blame when things like this are revealed later. Both the Rangers and the Special Forces soldiers were under direct American command. Now, I'll go into some of this, as I say, next week in detail about this article in case you don't get the Berkeley Barb. You can send for it, just Berkeley, California, October 3rd, the issue. It's September 27th, October 3rd. And I think it's a very important article, and we'll share it on the air, but I think it would be nice for people who are into serious research to get this article. It mentions Mr. Del Solar in the article, that he was behind a game plan called Politica that was to arrange for the takeover of other countries. It was done in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Politica was a game plan for taking over Chile. And Mr. Solar realized later that they had used his plan, the Pentagon had used his plan to take over Chile, and he felt responsible for the death of Allende because the Pentagon had used his particular plan. In the article I wrote for The Realist on why was Patricia Hearst kidnapped, I referred to Del Solar and the game plan Politica and the American plans to overthrow Chile. It's important to read these details because it was President Gerald Ford who defended the CIA role in Chile, who didn't see anything wrong with it, didn't think the CIA was meddling, and he passed the whole thing off. It's the President of the United States with evidence coming in as glaring as the evidence on the Warren Commission that Lee Harvey Oswald did not kill John Kennedy. Gerald Ford is playing the major role of cover-up in the tradition of Richard Nixon or Lyndon Johnson, and the President continuously defends the Pentagon because he is the Pentagon. He is selected there because he defends the position of the military, not because he's going to investigate the military. This week, the CIA was under investigation and was in the headlines. Many, many articles. Senator Howard Baker, Senator Lowell Weicker, still probing into the activities of the CIA in Chile. Now, it's very interesting that Mr. Baker and Mr. Weicker were blind to all the operations and all the books on the CIA until they got involved on the Senate Select Committee to investigate the Watergate. And then they came out with overwhelming evidence that the CIA was behind the Watergate affair. But instead of putting their thrust to attack everything that every man did in the CIA that contributed to the Watergate or was behind it, like Richard Helms, the director of the CIA, later Mr. Colby of the CIA, or Mr. Cushman, who's head of the Marines, or Mr. Walters, this team that's worked with Richard Nixon since he was vice president, instead of going into investigating what the CIA is doing in America, the thrust of the cover-up of the investigation of the CIA is to transfer everything over to Chile. Because Allende is already dead, Chile is delivered to Rockefeller family and ITT, so now they're just talking about old events, and they say, well, we'll have to put a watchdog on that agency. You don't need the CIA anymore if you have Mr. Rockefeller and multinational corporations, investing and taking home their CIA fronts. And so now the senators are saying, we have to investigate the CIA in Chile, where their job, all last summer we watched them on television, and this year should have been to investigate and prosecute and remove from office the CIA that is overthrowing the United States. It's so safe for them to talk about Chile, but what about us? And they're coming in their investigations to the conclusions that the CIA or the large corporations and the State Department and Henry Kissinger created a form of economic chaos because they wouldn't support Allende. They supported the strikes. They wanted unrest there and economic chaos as an excuse to depose Allende. But these same senators refuse to investigate the fact that everyone in this country is afraid of a depression, the prices are going up, we're going to be faced with strikes, and that the economic chaos that we're feeling is what the same agencies tested in Vietnam, tested in Greece, Philippines, South Korea, Chile, in order to gain control. They manipulate us here. So I wish that Mr. Baker, Senator Howard Baker, and Lowell Weicker put their head into arresting or indicting the people from the CIA who broke the law and meddled in domestic affairs. They provided not only wigs and cameras, they developed film, they provided safe houses for the Watergate, they destroyed typewriter tapes, important documentary evidence, they misled the FBI. The agents, James McCord and E. Howard Hunt, were working. Martinez of the CIA was still under the employ the night he was arrested at the Watergate. How do you separate all the CIA agents involved in the past political assassinations leading up to the Watergate from what they're doing in the United States today, including the creation of the SLA? So it's very safe for these men to look into the causes of what happened in Chile instead of directing their attention where they're supposed to be directing it, to the United States. Mr. Colby was called before a Senate committee and asked his opinion about Mr. Rockefeller. I don't know if I read this to you last week or not, where they asked Mr. Rockefeller, Mr. Colby, head of the CIA, he was pressed on whether he would provide assurances that corporations controlled by vice presidential nominee Rockefeller and his family would not be used as CIA covers in the future. This is Mr. Colby of the CIA was asked, would Vice President Rockefeller and his family be used as CIA covers in the future? And the answer Mr. Colby gave was, this would not be a useful subject for me to discuss. Now that is the most insulting answer. It's no answer at all. Of course it would be useful to know if when you get rid of the CIA agents, disguised as ambassadors or so forth, if you're going to use your large corporations. We've been using them all along, but he does not commit himself. He says that that's something that I'm not going to discuss. It's not useful to discuss this. So he's asked an intelligent question about the use of espionage outside the United States, and his answer is that isn't very useful to discuss. This is from the Washington Post, September 18th, 1974. The answer of Mr. Colby to the corporates being sources of overthrowing governments, which we know they've been. And in the last analysis, as you study the history of the 60s and 70s, I'll say what I've said many, many times when people ask me who's behind these conspiracies. What I have to say is that the CIA is simply a hired group of mercenaries that not only are supposed to give you intelligence about enemies abroad, but they are a secret private army that overthrows many, many countries in order to keep in hands of the wealth in the hands of a selected few in the United States. That was the purpose of forming the CIA. The gathering of intelligence is one small part of it. I just read a news report when I came in the studio today, and I have some of the figures at home of are selling $21 billion worth of weapon overseas to 51 countries. Those are 51 dictatorships that will keep the minimum wage or slave wages in other countries that allow torture and genocide. And we have a new kind of capitalism in this country. Our profits and economy are bolstered by making billions of dollars worth of weapons, guns, airplanes, and tanks that ensure the profit for the corporates to take home for their own pocketbook. And that's why the Rockefellers can amass such fortunes. Last week we talked about the lockup in the prison when Ron Wood was removed from San Quentin, then to Soledad, and then to the Nevada jail. His life was in danger, and he asked to be sent to another jail. And Ron Wood is the inmate who was in a cell next to Sirhan Sirhan up at San Quentin. And he got information about the murder of Robert Kennedy, and he wanted to pass this along in the form of articles or expose. He mailed out two letters, which I'll have next week. I've talked to somebody from Nevada who has the copy of his letters. I'll read them to you on the air next week, hopefully. But he got two letters mailed out of the jail, and he knew his life was in danger, but he took a chance to expose the truth about the Robert Kennedy assassination, and Ron Wood was murdered. Well, this week, another famous prisoner in the California prison system has been put under tight security restrictions again. And that's Charles Manson. And Manson was kept separated from the bulk of the prison population for quite a long time. But Manson, like Wood, tried to smuggle a letter out this week. He tried to send a letter out of the prison in the same manner that Wood did, and Wood was murdered last week. And it has been confirmed that was a contract murder. Until last week, Charles Manson was allowed greater freedom and movement and more contact with other inmates. A California medical facility at Vacaville, and now new restrictions were put upon him because he allegedly was writing to an unidentified girlfriend. Many researchers were shocked when I began to link the Sharon Tate murder and the LaBianca murders and the murders of five other people in addition to Sharon Tate in her home to past political assassinations, and they are linked to the National Security Council and the military operations. The Tate-LaBianca massacres were engineered behind the scenes by the law enforcement agencies and military intelligence. In fact, one of the agencies, Sheriff Peter Pitches in Los Angeles, is being investigated for other matters this week, and the investigations could keep mounting. The charges include many things, but not a behind-the-scenes role in the Manson case, which will come out in time, because all of this will come out in time. Manson was a child of the prison institutions with a gift of music and a love of women, and he was a selected patsy for this particular massacre. But as he becomes more aware of what happened to him, how he got involved, say, in the cell with Alvin Creepy Karpus when he was in jail, that was the man that made J. Edgar Hoover famous, his first big catch. Manson was in the cell with Karpus, and he received certain instructions and things, advice or hints of where to go or money to pick up. Manson was in connection with a very dangerous team, and I don't believe he realized any more than Lee Harvey Oswald realized how he was used until it all came down. Sirhan Sirhan, Charles Manson, James Ray, Arthur Brammer, our selected famous patsies, have all been isolated. And they're kept apart from the inmates at institutions, and they're not allowed contact with the outside world. And when they argue with the outside world, then their fate is similar to Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby. So we have to ask ourselves, what is in these letters? Why can't they send out letters? What information is there on their cases? Their lawyers are selected by the CIA for the most part. How can they get the truth of what is happening to them or what they did in the past without the fear of being murdered? Once they're used in a job, knowingly or unknowingly, they can't find their way out, and the authorities are shaking with fear. Why are the prison guards locking Charlie Manson up? Because a letter was found in somebody else's cell that he was sending to a girl. Well, a careful investigation would show links of the criminal intelligence in the state of California to the CIA through our Attorney General, Evel Younger. And the inmates here, as in other states, are not allowed to tell how they were used in these political conspiracies. Evel Younger, incidentally, is running in California for district attorney this year against William Norris for the attorney general. And I don't usually do political campaigning on Dialogue Conspiracy, but I do want to go into the difference between William Norris and Evel Younger for the California listeners. And also it's important at a national scene, because if Evel Younger doesn't get reelected, he will get a large federal appointment. So you still, coast to coast, have to know the name Evel Younger. He is a member of the CIA intelligence. He's a major general in military intelligence. He's a direct link to the Pentagon and the White House, and he's the Attorney General of California and in charge of the prisons, so there isn't much chance that whether it's from Dallas, Texas, or California, or whatever jail, that things can leak out from the inmates themselves. The investigation has to be done from the outside in. One of the big arguments I've had about against the death penalty, which is different than everybody else's, and I never see anybody mention it, is the fact that these political patsies are murdered or can be murdered legally, which provides an excuse to erase the circumstances by which the government is changed or our society is changed or our social opinions are changed. A Mr. Amsterdam from Stanford University has been very vocal in fighting the death penalty. Again, our Attorney General Evel Younger pushed it as hard as he could to get it through, and he succeeded in this state. Mr. Amsterdam's argument, as well as others, Mr. Bond back east, fighting the death penalty, is that the majority that get this are black, or they're unattractive physically, or they're poor, and therefore there's an uneven balance to the death penalty. But not one of these ever bring out the point of the use of the death penalty, if it's legalized, to select political patsies that are used by the military intelligence. And once they're murdered, we can't reconstruct their crime. There's a new lawyer, judge in the Wayne Chenault case in Atlanta, Georgia, said that Chenault should receive the death penalty for murdering Mrs. Martin Luther King. And there was another deacon of the church in Atlanta that was murdered the same day. Well, Chenault had a death list of 10 other people who are going to die, who are prominent, well-known. Among them was Aretha Franklin. Most of them were black ministers, Cecil Williams in San Francisco, Jesse Jackson, well-known black leaders. And John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, asked this week that there be no death penalty for Chenault, but on the basis that Mrs. King was nonviolent and wouldn't have wanted it. But I don't know how John Conyers, who's on Richard Nixon's enemy list, as were all black members of Congress, how he can miss the point that Wayne Chenault went to Atlanta, taken there by another male. He'd never been to Atlanta before, any more than James Raven in Memphis, Tennessee, the day that Martin Luther King was killed. He was taken by another man. He was seen in the company of another man. He was taken to the church, and then he was asked, where is Mrs. King? And he was told what to do, and he was obviously part of a continuing conspiracy to murder all black leaders. And as I say, there are other prominent people on the list. So John Conyers doesn't ask if Wayne Chenault was drugged. He doesn't ask if he was hypnotized. He doesn't ask if he was electrically or surgically controlled, if he had a mastoid operation recently, if he had medical attention, if he was in the presence of a hypnotist, because hypnotists worked with Jack Ruby. Billy Del Mar and David Ferry were hypnotists, two known, and goodness knows how many others could have been involved. Hypnotists have been used in the past political conspiracies. But the argument of humanitarianism is, I believe in that too. I don't believe in the death penalty in any case, even if it's not a complicated conspiracy for murder. But by rushing through the death penalty, it's so much easier to erase all the links that these people have with selected agents. The same problem exists for Mr. Kerbegovich down in Los Angeles that we did some shows on, this L.A. bomber who was responsible for three deaths at the Los Angeles airport and Greyhound Station, the bomb scares. He led two separate lives, one of a mute, one of a talker. He had a master's degree in two subjects. He was a refugee from Eastern Europe, making $1,000 a month, trained in using bombs and germ warfare. He created a lot of confusion down there. So immediately after his arrest, instead of taking it to the court in the normal channel, the municipal court, in the normal channel that it would go through, District Attorney Joseph Bush, who also worked on other political conspiracies and assassinations and who was hurrying to get those charges on this Patty Hearst thing with the flimsiest of information or basis of charging Patty Hearst, D.A. Bush comes in and, as the Los Angeles Times says, he gave no reason for his change in strategy. The decision was to go to the grand jury and complete the nature of this case. Bush would handle it himself. Now, this poor man, Kerbegovich, was working for a laboratory, as I say, where he brought in chemical warfare and gases. But the man, the employer could say it, RPM Industries, he didn't talk. We never spoke to him in 2 years, and that gets him off the hook, because on a need-to-know basis, they can say we never conversed what he was doing. But if we kill this man, we'll never understand how the international police and the CIA bring a man from Europe, Eastern Europe, into Canada, into the United States, get him a job working in a lab in Los Angeles, and then he spreads terror, because there's a direct link between the planning of terror and the mad bombers and the Central Intelligence Agencies. As a matter of fact, Lewis Tackwood was at the house this last week for a couple of days, and I thought he would be at the station today to show with me when he went down to L.A., left last night. And we did a three-hour show in WBAI New York. They called the house and to talk, and Tackwood had never been on the radio in New York, and so it was quite a treat for them to be able to talk to him and learn some of the things that are going on out here in California. Tackwood is the agent provocateur who worked for the police department for 9 years, and he was explaining the mad bomber down in L.A. that worked with the police department, or how Tackwood was hired by the Los Angeles Police Department to bomb certain buildings or to do certain, frame certain people and blame it on the leftists or on radicals. Now, this is the kind of thing we have to keep bringing up and going into every week, because otherwise it won't sink into people's heads that the police department do, in fact, hire murderers, and they blame it on the left or blame it on these crazy terrorists, when in fact there's a concerted effort to get more police and bring on a police state. Now, there are many ways. I'm going to go into the comparisons of the Jack Ruby sickness and the Richard Nixon sickness, so we can watch it in the next few weeks. There are many ways to eliminate individuals by military intelligence. The book I'm doing called Murderville USA tries to compile a recording. I'm recording the deaths as a political tool, the motives that people would want to murder in the intelligence, like taking over the presidency or eliminating candidates or people who know too much, who are ready to talk, for example, like Mr. Wood or Manson, or people who are directly involved as part of conspiracies who have to be silent. and then there's people no longer useful to the military intelligence operations. And the methods of murdering are varied. You can have hired assassins. You can use various kinds of weapons, automobile accidents, airplane accidents, boatings. There's poisoning food, apple pie and other foods, injections of air bubbles. You can have automobile accidents, such as Murray Chotiner was hit by a car, Clay Shaw. Murray Chotiner was a well-known friend of Richard Nixon's, a determining witness in the Vesco case. He would have been in Melt case, many important Watergate exposures. Clay Shaw was the gentleman that was arrested by Jim Garrison as being part of the conspiracy to kill John Kennedy, and Robert Crown was hit by a car, the assemblyman up in California. And this last week, Chief Justice Warren Burger was hit by a car. And the first report said that he fell off of his bicycle, which is okay. You had a 10 speed, they go pretty fast, and he was hit off a bicycle. But then the New York Times, September 24th, said that he was hit. This is what the New York Times said, that Chief Justice Burger broke a finger, cartilage separation on a rib, cut over his eye, a dislocated shoulder, bruises on his left hip and thighs. He's under treatment at Naval Hospital in Bethesda, Maryland. For you constant researchers, that rings a bell, too, the Bethesda. The first story was that he was crowded against the curb by an automobile. New York Times, September 24th, said that he was hit by a car. The very first story in the New York Post on the 21st said that he was crowded by an automobile. Now, it's interesting that the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court is knocked off and knocked unconscious. The car that hit him didn't stop. It was reported not to have stopped. That reminds you of the movie Z. The driver has not yet been identified, and it was not known who notified the police of the incident. Chief Justice Burger was taken to the hospital at 10:43 by a rescue squad and believed to be unconscious for some time. He said he only blacked out for a short while. But you remember that Warren Burger and the Supreme Court had to make a decision whether it would be Richard Nixon holding his tapes a secret or whether the tapes would become exposed for the rest of the world to see, and therefore the president would have to resign before he was exposed. The vote was 8-0. The Supreme Court went against the president, and Warren Burger is out on his bicycle, and he's hit. Is it a conspiracy? I don't know. But it certainly is a strange circumstance that has parallels. And if you add them up, how many coincidences do there have to be before you can come to some pretty hard conclusions? Well, another parallel I wanted to go into today is the one of Richard Nixon in the hospital. He has what was described by medical experts as a phlebitis. You remember he was walking around with this phlebitis and going to Egypt and then coming home when most people are taken off their feet immediately. The second point is that we were told he had phlebitis for 10 years when he's had every medical test known to man in the past years as a candidate, as a president of the United States, and we were never told of any previous phlebitis. The third point is that the discovery of the phlebitis was July 1st, 1974, 1 year exactly after he was hospitalized for pneumonia. This is the pneumonia that he was suffering from when the White House tapes were spoken of at the Senate Select Committee, and Richard Nixon came right home from the hospital, and a doctor suggested, according to one news story, that he should go down to Camp David and go swimming. He was in the hospital for pneumonia, and 1 year later, exactly on the day, he's in the hospital he gets his phlebitis. We did a show about that in July. Now this week, the doctors are suggesting the phlebitis could be linked with cancer hidden in his body. And Dr. Lundgren, Nixon's physician, said he's including cancer among a long list of other possible causes, although no evidence that Mr. Nixon had developed a malignancy. And then it said Mr. Nixon was found unexpectedly to have an embolus, a blood clot, in his right lung. That was this week, the week of September 30th, 1974. Well, all of Richard Nixon's medical problems and diagnosis remind me, as I say, of another famous gentleman whose fate is linked directly to Richard Nixon's in that Dallas situation, the killing of Kennedy. Jack Ruby died of diseases that followed the same pattern and identical pattern, so I thought I should share them with you and see if Nixon pulls through or if he'll suffer the same fate as Jack Ruby. At the Jack Ruby was hired to murder Lee Harvey Oswald. The evidence exists all over the place among all the researchers to prove this without any doubt anytime the new commission or the Congress wants to open this matter up. Robert Oswald, testifying before the Warren Commission in February 22, 1964, said that he felt that I'm of the opinion, in quotes, that Mr. Ruby did in fact know Lee Harvey Oswald prior to Sunday, November 23rd, and that he was, in my opinion, paid to silence Lee Harvey Oswald, his brother. One example of the negligence of the Warren Commission was a John Crawford, who's 45 years old, who died in a mysterious plane crash in April 15, 1969. Crawford was a pilot for the Texas Department of Corrections. His name and phone number were kept with Jack Ruby in his pocket at all times. He was a close friend of Jack Ruby's, but he was also a lifetime friend of Buell Wesley Frazier, the man who drove Lee Harvey Oswald to the book depository the morning that Kennedy was killed. Now, Ruby was outside in front of the book depository the day that Kennedy was killed. He kept the name and phone number of his friend John Crawford in his pocket at all times, who worked for the Texas Department of Corrections. And Crawford was driving Lee Harvey Oswald to the book depository. The purpose of this broadcast isn't to show that Ruby was used by military intelligence, because we've gone into many of those before and we can do it again. But I want to go into his death report and show what happened, because Jack Ruby had a new lawyer and he was trying to open up the new investigation and have a new trial, for one thing. And he did tell the lawyer, as came over the news a few weeks ago, about the conspiracy. Another point is that Jack Ruby did exactly what Charlie Manson or Ron Wood did or are trying to do. He slipped a couple of letters out of the cell that ended up with Mr. Hamilton, an autograph collector at the Waldorf Astoria, in which he was naming Lyndon Johnson and oil men and Dallas people behind the murder of Kennedy, and that this was the reason he was hired to kill Lee Harvey Oswald. Well, from the time those little messages got written on pieces of paper and sneaked out, then it was just a matter of short time before Ruby died, and he was on his way to the next world to be silenced forever. Ruby knew all the Dallas cops. He owed $50,000 to the Internal Revenue, and there were many reasons for using Jack Ruby, but again, we won't go under those. One of the interesting articles that I have is that visitors were rare after Ruby was jailed. He was inaccessible except to family, lawyers, and other investigators. The newspaper headline from, I brought in a lot of newspaper clippings. This is from January the 3rd, the Herald Examiner, 1967. Ruby loses his fight for cancer. It says, Ruby was removed to a hospital after complaining of an illness which jail doctors were treating as a bad cold for 3 weeks. It was first diagnosed as pneumonia, then cancer, which spread in the lymph glands. Ruby looked like a man of 80. He was only 55. Remember last year that we had our president had pneumonia, and this year they're looking for a cancer following that pneumonia. Another article, January the 8th, 1967, AP Wire Service says, Ruby was undergoing constant medical supervision, both for his body and mind, in the Dallas jail. He was treated for 3 weeks for a cold. He had an admission to Parkland Hospital for a diagnosis of pneumonia. Then later tests showed he had cancer in the pancreas, lungs, and lymph glands, and he was dying. Just hours after he was diagnosed as having cancer, a blood clot failed him, and that was the end of Jack Ruby. It was a very quick cancer, for those of you that don't remember the event, but you can look up in your libraries the news accounts from January 67. Now, I have a headline of a Long Beach newspaper dated January the 4th, 1967. And this newspaper is interesting. Long Beach, that's where Richard Nixon is now. And we'll quote some experts, medical experts from Long Beach. But this says, when Jack Ruby first learned he had cancer, he was convinced it had been inflicted on him by the police. He said the cancer germs were introduced into his system secretly while he was in jail. For a while, they thought he had pneumonia. That Jack Ruby was proof. He thought that there was mustard gas that was seeped into his cell. And later, when the diagnosis was changed to cancer, he thought that the germs were given to him to murder him. Now, remember, David Ferry, who knew Jack Ruby and Clay Shaw and Oswald, was working with mice and cancer-inducing experiments. He was a scientist as well as airplane pilot and a priest. And He was working with injections of cancer. Ruby became convinced that his killing of Oswald had set off a pogrom in the United States that eventually would affect the Jews in this country, but he was also convinced at the end that he was the victim of a conspiracy. This is the Long Beach Independent, January the 4th, 1967. Ruby thought that he was being injected with cancer. Ruby's family had a news conference. This was in Chicago at the time of his burial. These are UPI stories, January the 5th, 1967, if you want to look them up. Jack Ruby's family charged that he'd been neglected by the Dallas authorities for months before his death, and they said that he died of mental anguish. Ruby, who was suffering from cancer, died at Parkland Hospital from a blood clot in the lungs. You see the comparisons here. He had a blood clot, first cold, then a pneumonia, then it went into a blood clot to the lungs, and the anxieties were causing him cancer. Now the doctors are telling you maybe Richard Nixon has cancer, so maybe there's an overlap. Here are some authorities from Long Beach, California, at the time Ruby had his cancer. This is an article in the Los Angeles Times by Harry Nelson, Times medical editor. It says, the possibility that growth of cancer, which killed Ruby, may have been enhanced by his emotional state is being considered seriously by some physicians. I'm reading this now because you see with Nixon's emotional problems that the doctors can swing to that his worries are giving him the cancer. The speculation hangs on the theory, still unproved, that a relationship exists between a rapid growth of cancer and an intense but unresolved feeling. It is possible, some doctors believe, that changes in body chemistry, which are known to accompany intense psychological stress, create certain circumstances, a body environment which is unfavorable to the growth of cancer. There are dozens of reports to show psychological influence causing factor. The disease is more apt to occur in certain persons. It looks like it's occurring in political patsies, the way that things are falling down now. It's that there's no definite answer yet. There's definitely some relationship between stress and a deep sense of personal failure, according to Dr. Charles Wall, chief of the Division of Psychosomatic Medicine at UCLA. I hope he isn't part of that UCLA team that would study the causes of violence. Dr. Saul Baker, past president of the California Division of American Cancer Society, contradicts the UCLA expert and says there is no evidence to support the notion that Ruby's cancer may have been caused by emotions, but the other psychiatrist went back to say psychological stress can cause anxiety. The doctors said they can point out the emotions can be responsible for chemical and physical changes in cell growth. Now, there's another article. Two Long Beach medical experts speculated that Jack Ruby's rapid demise from cancer might be attributed to his depressed attitude. Dr. Wallace Ellerbrook, a surgeon, I'm positive at this point that's how people think it's the primary cause of cancer. He's been studying cancer for 7 years. And in 1951, Dr. Eugene Blumberg, also a Long Beach clinical psychologist, said people with anxiety and depression are more likely to have a rapid downhill course in cancer rather than a long-distance diagnosis. So you see with Richard Nixon's pressures and his anxieties, and he is at the Long Beach Hospital, how they could go from a blood clot in the leg to a cancer in 1 week or possible cancer. So I think we should follow the medical reports as they fumble along with the treatment of Richard Nixon. Dr. Blumberg said, it is my guess that Ruby was moody and frequently depressed. If a serious depression did exist, Ruby was the type of person to have a rapid downhill course. Dr. Blumberg cited a medical journal that said lung cancer patients have a poor outlet for emotional discharge. So Ruby then had a lung cancer, but he died of a blood clot to the heart, and the diagnosis was as jammed up there as it is in all of these famous cases. Here's another article. Ruby Oswald Slayer dies of a blood clot in the lungs. If you just transpose these names, you see Richard Nixon with the phlebitis, the blood clot, the possible cancer, the pneumonia last year. Here's Dr. Earl Rose, the Dallas County Medical Examiner, who said Ruby had extensive cancer. He was killed by a blood clot in the lungs. He was 55. And remember, he had extensive cancer, but there wasn't a symptom until his sister mentioned that he had been vomiting in the cell for a few weeks and didn't get medical attention, which could also be a poison. Dr. Rose, who performed an autopsy, said the blood clot apparently formed in his leg this morning, in Jack Ruby's leg, and traveled through his heart to the lungs. The examiner said it was a massive clot that would probably have killed Ruby even if he hadn't been weakened by cancer. In other words, he didn't have a chance either way. Ruby's death, however, was not completely unexpected. He might have developed blood clots. He showed signs yesterday. He might have developed blood clots. This morning he was comfortable. He ordered eggs and breakfast and was jovial. At 9 a.m. he was seized with a spasm, and that was the end of Jack Ruby. Jack had trouble keeping food on his stomach, and they thought it was just his nerves, so they were treating with penicillin and gave him cough syrup. Now, it'd be interesting to know if he received injections, because keep in mind that Jack Ruby was sick 3 weeks. Cold, pneumonia, multiple cancer, blood clot, and it's Dr. Rose said the preliminary examination of the brain lining didn't disclose any epilepsy. That was the excuse for his shooting Oswald. Dr. Rose and Dr. Frankel, who held a news conference at 4 p.m., this is January the 4th, 1967, refused to say that Ruby's cancer caused the blood clot that killed them. Dr. Rose said it did and it didn't. I won't say yes or no. There's a predisposition for people with tumors to develop blood clots in the legs. Now, all of this may be true, but first you have to prove that Ruby had a cancer. He said Ruby might have developed a small blood clot. He had trouble getting his breath. The medication to keep the blood from clotting was not administered. We didn't know that he was throwing clots. But he said it was a little unlikely that Ruby would have recovered from the cancer anyway. So there was massive cancer, but it didn't show up in any symptom until he had a cold, and then he didn't die from the cancer. He died from the blood clot in his lung. Here's another article on doctors at odds about Ruby's treatment. This is UPI service dated January the 5th, 1967. Jack Ruby received less than the best possible medical treatment in the Dallas County Jail. It was disclosed that the physical examinations and x-rays taken in 63-64 revealed no signs of cancer at all. Dr. Eugene Frankel said, "In a way, Ruby's situation in jail is like a man in the military. The medical care he gets may not be as thorough or sophisticated as a private doctor." And he was taken, he said, December the 9th, suffering from what was pneumonia, and then unexpectedly there was this blood clot in his leg that went to his heart, and in the meanwhile, they said he had a cancer. There's another article, January 5th, that the mortician in Chicago that received Ruby's body was given threatening calls and told him, "You better get security and you're going to have trouble at the funeral." And I'm sure the mortician or no doctor up in Chicago was able to do a second autopsy other than the one at Parkland Hospital to see exactly what Jack Ruby died of or how extensive the cancer was in his body. His funeral was very private, and Mr. Bert Griffin of the Warren Commission gave a statement at the time of the funeral to assure everybody that the Warren Commission investigated this matter into the matter of Jack Ruby to see if he knew Harvey Oswald, and there was absolutely no connection between Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald, which was an absolute lie. This Bert W. Griffin has lied. He hasn't said it under oath. He said it to the press. But there were connections. The Warren Report could have figured them out there through the documentation. Leads everywhere in Ruby's notebook, in his safe or files. The Warren Commission didn't use the evidence that Jack Ruby knew Lee Harvey Oswald. And when Jack Ruby sent a note out of the jail, like Ron Wood did, wanting to tell about the conspiracy, he had to be killed. Or Manson sends a letter, he loses his privileges. He has to go back into isolation. There was another article in the it was Associated Press at the time of Ruby's death where Marguerite Oswald, the mother of Lee Harvey Oswald, asked for a new examination of the assassination of John Kennedy and of her son, Lee Harvey Oswald, and, of course, Officer Tippit, and then Ruby. She said, there are unanswered questions. This is a UPI starting an AP. In January 67, there are unanswered questions. The Warren Commission worked under closed session, suppressed evidence, unchallenged contradictions, conflicting expert testimony, negligent commission procedures, misstatement of commission procedures. These points preclude the possibility of the complete truth being known to present and future generations of concerned Americans. She said, "Now we have circumstantial evidence to convict a group of people," she says, "it's a sleeper with a motive in this story, and that they should go into the killing of Jack Ruby." Well, that's it for today. Our time is up. I think the medical reports on Ruby and Nixon parallel closely enough that I thought I should share those with you today and show you what happens when these pathies want to talk. We should get the Justice Department into these things. Okay, I'll see you next week. Take care of yourself, and I'll be on hand next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KELRB-FM in Carmel, California.